We're back for the fourth in a series of conversations among men based on the book, Landmarks, Turning Points on Your Journey Toward God, released by B&H Publishing back in March of this year. My name is Bill Delveaux, and as the author of the book, I hope today's 30-minute conversation helps you move forward in your own journey with the living God. Joining me again is Daniel, my good friend and companion for these conversations, and new to this conversation series is another good friend, Bill. Men, it's great to have both of you here, and as we tell our stories and allow others to listen in, thanks for joining us here.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, thank you, Bill.
After having traveled the first three landmarks of story, idols, and wounds, we find ourselves now facing a fourth landmark, one that feels like trying to navigate through the Amazon jungle. This is landmark is simply entitled Sex. And here is the connection to the previous landmarks. Sex for nearly all men ends up functioning as the chief idol we use to substitute for God, or it feels like the chief wound we have received in life, or for some men, tragically, it's both. Much of the conversation about idols and wounds therefore applies here also, but this landmark feels so treacherous to negotiate because of all the guilt and shame that universally surround it. It really makes us feel like we're lost in the Amazon jungle, trying to hack our way out of it. We wonder at times if we're ever going to find that way. And of course, that brings us here to our conversation today. So much of our sexual insanity comes from our unwillingness to bring our sexual struggles out into the light with other men. Only when we do the really difficult and terrifying thing of telling our story will we be able to make some progress out of the jungle of this insanity. So what we wanted to do today is just that. We wanted to tell a bit of our story about this landmark. So that's where we're going to begin today, Bill and Daniel. So let's start by just talking about how sex sort of operated in our life, either as the chief idol or the chief wound or a little bit of both. So who wants to jump in here?
Well, I'll get started. Okay. You know, as a counselor, let me just start by saying I've never met an honest man who wouldn't agree with your statement that this is kind of universal in terms of idol and wound. But that was not my belief when I was younger and starting puberty and kind of discovering my body and desires. And if, you know, going back to one of the themes in my story was this pressure that I felt to always be mature and holy and strong and good. And so what that meant was anything in my life that was a struggle that didn't fit that facade, really, that I was trying to live out of, I had to go into hiding and underground. Yeah. And so one of the stories that I remember, I would have been maybe 10 years old, and I remember being at the grocery store with my mother and my two younger sisters. And one of the things she did at this point was she'd drop us off at the magazine rack. I think it was actually adjacent to the toy aisle and what was then the grocery store, and while she did her shopping. And so we'd flip through, you know, whatever magazines we could find. And there was a swimsuit magazine on the rack that was new to me. And I remember picking it up, and my sisters were there, and we were looking through it together. And I had a sense that something about this was off, but I didn't know quite how to think of it. So when my mother came back in a way that in my 10-year-old brain, I was trying to kind of test by her reaction, what even how to think about all the stuff that was stirred inside of me. I said, "Look, Mom, this magazine is bad." And she grabbed it from me and she said, "Well, then why are you looking at it?" And put it down on the rack, and we walked away, and that was all that we talked about it.
And so no follow-up conversation.
No follow-up conversation. So to me, the message was clear that I was looking at these images that in one sense there was such an innocence. You know, I'm sitting there with my sisters. We're all three looking. And there was something stirred in me as I looked at these images. Something I desired, and I didn't know how to make sense of it, and was not much conversation in my family. And out of my parents' own brokenness, I was kind of left to figure this whole issue of sexuality out on my own. And my conclusion was sex and sexual desire are bad, and I have to be good, so I can't be sexual. And if I am, I have to hide it. So that started many, many years of a kind of a dual life of externally, I was in some ways almost sexless. Girls that I dated, I never crossed any boundaries with them. You know, I was kind of the poster child of, this is who mothers you want your daughters to date because he's going to respect you. And that was true. But then in the darkness,
underneath all that,
there was a growing, just this struggle. And I did use it to medicate a lot of other pain in my life and became habitual. But I could never, I didn't think I could ever talk about it. It felt so shameful. And it felt like this is kind of the one place that grace can't touch. You know, I can be angry. Right. I can eat too much. I can be jealous. I can be afraid. I can be cowardly even, and I can talk about that, but I can't talk
proud
about, or proud. Yeah.
But not sex. We can't
I
go there.
I couldn't talk. That's right. Because this was the one thing that would disqualify me in my thinking from God's grace and the respect of anyone who knew me. So for many years, it was just kind of that closet. And so, yeah, sex for me was both a wound in that sense of not having a safe place to discover what it was even for.
Being shamed by that. The shame wounded you over and over.
Absolutely. But then also the idol, it just was kind of what I could control, and it worked.
Yeah, and that's it does work. And I want to jump in here because our stories have a lot of similarities. My experience with sex was very much the same. I had the only conversation I remember with my parents was I got a little booklet put on in my bedroom when I was about 11 or 12, sort of the basic facts of life, and that was it. There was never any type of conversation. So I sort of intuited whatever this is, you just sort of keep it under the rug. My first experience with sort of dealing with it openly in a way that was shameful was when I was 14, and it was kind of my first exposure to pornography. And at that time, I was already feeling very much alone, very much disconnected from my peers. I was, as I've said before, very much a geeky kid and didn't know where I was kind of fitting in. I was kind of first year into puberty. I'd shot up about 6 or 8 inches. And I was still taking piano lessons. And I remember I was released. It was the first time I remember sort of being without my parents around and alone and just kind of out in the world. And I would go and get lunch in between my piano lesson and my theory lesson. And there was a local drugstore, and I just remember going in, getting a hamburger, and I had some time to kill. I was just wandering around, and there was the magazine rack, kind of like yours. But I noticed these magazines that were tucked behind, and they had like covers on them. And of course, just being curious, I just sort of, you know, looked. And of course, there it was. It was sort of the old printed pornography in the magazine form. And I just, you know, curiosity, I'd heard about this. And I remember in the sixth grade, maybe sort of seeing it a little bit with a couple of other buddies. But this was sort of my chance to kind of explore this by myself. And I remember pulling it out, and I think probably for somewhere between 30 and 45 minutes, those moments where I dove into not only the visual images, but sort of the spoken descriptions, I can remember those things went so deep inside of me. It was like sort of that first experience of having that sort of take root. And again, no context or understanding not only the sexual drive I was feeling, but just sex in general. This was sort of my first, you know, I was sort of like the dry sponge, and all of a sudden the water sort of comes down. I just soaked it all up. And it's like, I was just glued to it. And finally I looked down and it was like, I've got to go to my theory lesson. And I remember just hastily putting the magazine back up on the rack, walking out, and just these terribly dark emotions of what just happened to me. what was that? And then the immediate sense of guilt, like, I know I shouldn't be doing that. And the immediate sense of shame, there's something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And that started a whole cycle of off and on, probably before about 10 years, mm-hmm. of using pornography as an anesthetic, just because I felt so disconnected from my peers, ashamed. I had growing depression at the time. And so it was that whole cycle of pornography and masturbation was sort of my anesthetic to deal with what was going on inside. Of course, it only made things worse, but I didn't have any other context to go on. So for me, when I look back on it, it was sort of the idol I used and sort of clung to, but in a very shameful way. So that's kind of was my first story with sex.
You know, I think mine is really grows out of a wound, and to kind of set the table, kind of what Daniel did. I was 12 years old. I also went through puberty early for my age, and was involved with a lot of things as a kid. And one of them was scouting, and there was this particular guy that I really admired. Was 5 years older than me. He was everything I wanted to be. He could drive a car. He was getting ready to go to college. He's sort of like the big brother I never had. And to make a sort of a long, long story rather short here, during the course of camping one summer, I had an incident with him where he lured me back to the back part of the cabin and had an incident where he sexually abused me. And I remember when that particular episode came to a close, and to this day I couldn't tell you whether it lasted 5 minutes or 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I remember diving back into my bunk and going, two things came through my mind. One is, I can never ever tell my mom and dad about this. And secondly, how could I have been so stupid for something like this to happen? I will never ever let anybody make me look stupid again.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of, that became, unbeknownst to me, over the next several years, sort of a mantra of mine. One is that particularly the part about I will never ever let anyone make me look stupid again, because I felt like had I been a little bit more on my guard, had I been a little bit sharper, a little bit clearer thinking, I could have seen that coming and I could have headed that off. You got to remember, when I was that age, I had never heard the term sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that term until years and years later. I certainly had no working definition of it till many, many years later. So I go through life. There's junior high school and high school and college all ahead of me, young adulthood as being single. I have what I consider to be normal dating relationships. Like Daniel, I stayed pure until I got married, thought that was the right thing to do, was raised that way. And unbeknownst to me, that I had sort of had taken that mantra, and it had kept me protected in a lot of ways, but it also kept me shut down, and shut down primarily from the whole aspect of intimacy. So when you get married, everything about intimacy comes front and center. And all your uncomfortableness, or in my case, all fear has to come out. So what I saw was that this that I had buried for 20 years all came up. And it came up in just hard ways that were tough on my marriage, tough on being able to let down and be real to my wife and to see, it's not that I had the desire for sex. I had I'd waited. I thought that was good.
Right.
You got to remember, at this time, not only am I married, but I also have one child and another one on the way. And all of a sudden, this stuff comes crashing down on me. And it took a lot of years with a lot of counselors and a lot of patience and time and prayer and all that stuff to kind of unknot this whole thing, is to realize what that had done to me.
Right. And one of the phrases I know you use, which I think is so characteristic, you talk about how the image you created.
Right.
And I think your term is image and management software. You were an expert at that.
Yeah, it was right on my front drive. And so as part of this, not ever letting anybody look stupid, I was going to keep my image up.
Yes.
And I was going to do it at all levels, whether it was social, whether it was academic, athletic, all that stuff. I had friends. I had a great life. But, man, I was constantly, constantly managing that image because I was deathly scared that somebody was going to make me look stupid again.
Right.
Because
right.
I had screwed up. I had screwed up. I had let somebody do that to me.
Right. And that's, I think when those who experience sexual abuse, one of the places that is so common, it's like, I did something wrong. It's my fault.
Yeah.
And it's the exact opposite.
That's right.
There's a perpetrator and you've been abused. And so to actually unpack all that and get all that right, it's a really flip in your thinking,
mm-hmm.
to begin to think that way rightly.
Yeah.
So this is really interesting because we have a story of a one that was wounded, Bill, and you, and for me it's definitely an idol, and for you, Danny, you kind of put words to it being both. And let's move it a little bit forward and talk about how it affects us as men. And I guess the best way to put it is this. I know for me, and I think many, many other men, our struggles with sex, we think that's our core issue. If we somehow can iron this out and get this all managed out, we will have sort of the straight and narrow path forward. And yet we can, we can't, not only do we struggle to sort of manage it on our own, but it really fogs what the crucial issue is in our life, which is a sense, not ironing out our sexual issues, but our sexuality. And I think when we begin to come clean and begin to sort of process our sexual issues in a way, and God begins to heal us of them through repentance or confession or simply beginning to talk about them or a combination of that, we begin to realize that that's not the core issue. Our core issue isn't sex. Our core issue is our sexuality. We don't really have a sense of solidity as men. We don't know what it really like is to feel like a man and to walk out of that strength. So can we talk just a little bit about that whole process of coming to terms with our sexual issues and then sort of coming to terms with that sense of our sexuality and the void there? Who wants to start that one?
Yeah, I'll start. Well, for me, God was very gracious to me over the years of starting, it was junior year of high school, I think, the first conversation that was even close to being honest about this with an older mentor, and then I had some friends in college, and again, I was maybe 60% honest with them in terms of the struggle, because I really did love God, even in the midst of all that, and I really did want to walk in holiness, and I wasn't sure how, and there was this haunting of, I'm not who I want to be, and I don't know how to get there. And it wasn't until my mid-20s that I was really, there are a couple circumstances, but really I was forced to have to come just really clean, and sought some counseling and part of a men's group for a couple years where kind of our common theme was sexual brokenness, and that was pretty humiliating. And I'll tell you though, that began a process, a journey for me, where I discovered two very important truths. One was that my sexuality is something that God loves. And sex is something God loves, and it's a gift.
He created it.
And created.
And everything created is good.
That's right. And all that he made my body to be was supposed to be an image and reflection of my soul.
Right.
And so my desires and the drive of being a man and what all that meant, to go from it feeling just like there's only shame to that, yes, there's sin that needs to be repented of. Yes, there's brokenness there, but it wasn't only sin. It was more than just that. And that God, this is a place that he delights in me. Not in the directions I went with it, but fundamentally when he made me a sexual being.
Yeah.
And then two, G.K. Chesterton has a quote. He said, every man that knocks on the door of a brothel or to visit a prostitute is really knocking, looking for God.
I love that quote.
I do too. Yeah. And the idea that when I was letting my mind and my body go to sexual places from the time I was in middle school on, that really what I was craving was something very valid and good, and it was God. I was wanting to worship. And I didn't, until I made that connection, did I see that, real practically, and going back again to my story of feeling I always had to be on and strong, what I wanted, craved, was comfort,
right,
and to be not in charge of something, and to be, I wanted to rest and feel pleasure and rest and delighted in, and not have to make something happen to have that experience. And sex just became this perfect outlet. And so while resisting temptation certainly was something to learn and wrestle with, and again, yes, it was sinful, part of my healing journey and continues the journey I'm continue to be on is to recognize what, when I'm feeling those desires and the drive to go in certain directions, what is the place that God wants to meet me in? Yeah. And it wasn't until I made that connection that I really started to gain some traction in turning the ship in my life.
Yeah. Wow, that's some very powerful things you just said then, put some good words and language to it. You know, I know for me, my whole sense of being sexual was, you know, just my sexual issues. For me, gaining clarity there has, in one sense, was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Confession, like you said, coming, you know, just beginning to talk it out with people. But what it did was it opened up for me what I really longed for was a connection that was really missing in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought masculinity was about proving something mm-hmm. to others, and it was something that I never thought yeah. I could prove. And so I was in this repetitive pattern of always having to do that. And masculinity fundamentally is not about proving anything. It's right. about connecting.
Right.
It's about connecting to first of all, to our fathers and to other men, but principally, ultimately, that's an echo of connecting to the living Father himself, the God of all, the Father of all compassion, the God of all comfort. And when we mm-hmm. when we do that and feel that, that's our core sense of strength.
Right.
And I couldn't do that because I was so covered over with so much shame and sadness. And one of the things the Lord kind of revealed to me was simply this: behind the shame is the man.
Yeah.
Behind the shame, particularly of our sexual issues, is the man. And once we uncover that and let the Lord have that shame in our lives,
sure.
the man who we really are can start to come out and connect and feel that strength. So that's been kind of my journey.
Hmm.
Bill, what about you?
You know, I couldn't agree more that sex is not the core issue. It, for me, it was the screaming symptom, though, and so I had to kind of.
And it does scream, doesn't it?
Yeah, right. Because as men, and you, sex is the preeminent and dominant marker for masculinity.
Yeah.
In other words, we're going to be the best at it. Each one of us are, and conversely,
another way to prove ourselves.
It's another way to prove ourselves, and conversely. If we have any issues with it, we are convinced we are the only ones. Whether it's an addiction issue with pornography, or whether it's this intimacy issue, or that we've been sexually abused, we are convinced that we're it. And to share that, by golly, is death.
Right.
Yeah, or it'll be the end of us. We'll be laughed out of the county, whatever the case may be. And I think with me, once I first of all, I had to start telling that to trained counselors and therapists and start unpackaging that. And then it really was the gateway to understanding that this image management software was cloaking intimacy at all levels, on the human horizontal level and also on the vertical
right,
level.
Right.
And once I started to give way to that and just say, you know what, I've got to drop that. And it was not an easy thing to drop. It's so hard.
You do a little bit
little
like
pieces,
test the waters here, test the water there.
Right, little pieces like that. And all of a sudden, you realize that the sexual component is just, like I said, the screaming symptom, not the core issue.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a gradual healing of, one, you start with therapists, then you start with small groups of folks, and then you start with good friends that you can tell. Certainly, I told my wife. And you know what's eventually, I got a chance to tell my parents. You know, some, you know, 40
wow.
years or more after the, 35 or 40 years after the
that
event.
That must have been an amazing conversation.
It was. And so, you know, to be able to kind of explain to them where my mind was at 12 versus where it was as a much older adult at that time. And so all of that contributes to the healing. But I would say that the healing continues to the day. Even this conversation that we're having among
mm-hmm.
friends
mm-hmm.
is healing.
Mm-hmm.
It's healing to hear the two of you guys talk to me.
Yeah.
And it's healing to tell mine again.
Yeah.
So.
And I've had that experience listening to many stories of men. And everybody has a story.
Yes.
Every man has a story. I haven't heard one that doesn't. And it really is, you know, it really is universal. We all struggle here deeply and don't really know what to do with it often.
Yeah.
We just have a few minutes. And so just I'm curious, and you've already mentioned this too. What's it like? This is not a conversation most men ever have, just
right.
sitting around and talking honestly about our stories of sex. What's it like? Just doing this right now for y'all?
Well, I would say it is a mixture. It is a mixture of, there is certainly the temptation to feel shame, mixed with the gratitude of the story God's been telling in my life, that I actually am willing to have my voice recorded. You know, so when this goes viral and the millions of people hear it, you know, that shame doesn't drive my decisions, doesn't have to drive my decisions. And it is a place where I've discovered with practice, and I've had lots of it, talking openly about the reality of this does just keep bringing the reality of the gospel back into my life.
It's kind of like what Bill said, it's healing.
It's absolutely, easier way to say it, better way to say it, it's healing. The gospel that, you know, I'm sinful and broken and this world is not my home, and God has stepped into that and does every day in my life and is loving me in it and redeeming my story. Mm-hmm. When we can talk about the details, it takes it from being a head knowledge to a heart transformation experience.
Yeah. Right. Do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, Daniel said it so well. You know, the thing I would encourage is if men hear this, our collective stories, and particularly if there's a man out there that says, you know, there's something I need to tell somebody, and it's probably the thing that's going to scare them the most, but I would encourage them to know that is the thing, it is the shortest path to healing as far as getting on the path toward healing.
Right.
And I'm also reminded that I'm still a work in progress. The healing journey continues.
Right.
The insight, God's redemption never stops. You know, and doing something like this is just one of those steps along the path.
Yeah. You know, and for me, it was funny. While I was talking, I was in the back of my mind going, "This is such a hard issue to talk about. Am I saying the right thing? You know, am I doing it right?" And it's interesting to me because even though I've written about this and talked to many men about this, and it's still a place where there's that catch in us. It's just hard, but it is healing. Mm-hmm. It is wonderful. And Daniel, you said it yourself, our experience of God's presence and just who we are as men comes more and more as we begin to do this. We're going to stop here. Thanks all to all of you who've been listening in, and thank you to Bill and Daniel. Thank y'all so much for your courage and sharing your stories. And we'll be coming back next time to speak about the fifth landmark, which is identity, and I hope you'll join us then.